Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you enjoy the teachings from Beth Emmanuel, do us a favor and share the links with your friends. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends about the things you are learning at Beth Emmanuel. Help us grow the message.
The name of the lesson tonight is The Woman on the Beast, which is Revelation 17, of course. And we're just going to work our way through the chapter as per usual. It says, then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls, and we learned the seven bowls, of course, over the last week, or 2 weeks ago, last time we had class. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters. Note that she is seated beside many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality. And with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers of the earth have become drunk. Right, this is Bible talk for sure. We recognize this kind of imagery, this figurative imagery of intoxication and being seated by many waters. This all sounds like biblical language. What's really being conveyed here? Well, sexual immorality in this case, is it literal or figurative sexual immorality? It's actually both. I'm going to say what's being suggested here is both. That the sexual immorality that's being served up in this cup is not just low sexual standards and all sorts of crazy stuff going on, but rather this is frequently in the Bible a metaphor for idolatry itself. In this case, it's both. I look at it this way, because I'll just let you in on a little secret. The woman is Rome. What a surprise, right? Look at it this way. Rome is, of course, the major exporter of her religion, right? Because it's an empire, and the rule is, the law is, you have to worship the Caesars, and you have to worship the Roman gods. But also of her culture. Very similar to the way the United States, as the superpower, world superpower, and not just world superpower, but world super media superpower, we've exported our culture all over the world. There's not a lot you can say in defense of Muslim fundamentalism, but this is one of the things you can say in defense of Muslim fundamentalism, that when they call the United States the great Satan, we've also been exporting sexual immorality all over the world. Anyway, that's what I think of whenever I read this passage, is kind of make that equation. But that's not what it's talking about. Of course, it's speaking about the Roman era, the Roman world, the Roman culture, and idolatry. But before we go on, this brings up a question. I already spilled the beans and said we're talking about Rome here, and I'll try to make that case once again throughout the chapter. But I remember hearing this taught in Messianic Jewish teaching as, this is actually America. Have you ever heard that? That the woman who rides the beast is actually America. I mean, I suppose you could make some equation. I already made the obvious connection between the exporting of the sexual immorality and so forth. And we get into the next chapter, we're going to see world trade, you know, the center of world trade. And Rome was the world superpower of the day. The United States of America is the world superpower of this current day. So you can make some connections there. But let's play our rule, by our rule of how we're interpreting the book of Revelation. Would that have been an interpretation readily available to the first century believers to whom this epistle, this revelation was granted? No, of course not. Even though we might creatively reassign the symbolism, and perhaps Hashem himself will reassign the symbolism when it comes down to the end times, we don't know how things will play out. But as we're understanding it, for purposes of this class, we're understanding it from the apostolic perspective as it was intended in the first century. Okay, so we're sticking with, what a surprise, Rome. All right, so he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. When it says he carried me away in the spirit, we have already learned that in the spirit refers to consciousness, this state of altered consciousness. So in other words, it's a vision or something that he's experiencing. It's an apocalypse. It's another step of the apocalypse. He's carrying me away in the spirit into a wilderness. Why into a wilderness? So far, most of our apocalypses have been taking place up in the heavenly celestial spheres, or sort of from a bird's eye view of events on earth. But here we're carried into a wilderness. And the suggestion is, and this will come in the next chapter, that oftentimes in the Tanakh, the wilderness is presented as a place of death and unclean spirits, a place where evil spirits and unclean birds hang out. For example, think of our master going out into the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted by the who? By the Satan, right? And he encounters this evil spirit. Likewise, wilderness has that connotation sometimes in the scriptures, and that's probably what you have here. It's this idea of we're seeing into a spiritual wilderness, this dry and waterless places where the demons go out to wander and so forth. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast had 7 heads and 10 horns, not the woman. And we've already learned all this. So this isn't too difficult for us at this point, because we've already encountered this symbolism before in the class. We've already learned about the meaning of the multiple heads and the multiple horns and that sort of thing. But what about the woman? She's really the new element here. Who is this woman that we're being introduced to? And we'll figure that out as we go on, because it's going to tell us explicitly who the woman is. What does it mean she was sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names? Well, we've already seen the blasphemous names in Revelation chapter 13. We determined that these were the names of the Caesars as gods, being presented as gods, such as Domitian, who liked to be referred to as my Lord and my God, or preferred to be referred to as my Lord and my God. So it's attaching titles of divinity to the names of men. These are the blasphemous names. And the 7 heads and 10 horns. Did you notice that we first met the dragon and he had 10 heads? But here we've got 7 heads. So there is this difference between the 10 heads and the 7 heads. And we're going to try to... Right, so that was the suggestion I made, that, well, you know, you could, there's these extra three that we could count, right? So that might be, you could count the three, Vitellius, Galba, and Otho, weren't really Caesars. Their power was contested. It was during the Civil War after the death of Nero. That's one way to look at it. It's kind of a puzzle, though. And Rabbi Lichtenstein has a different suggestion for us tonight. Well, how can the woman represent Rome and the beast represent Rome? How about that? I mean, the woman's riding the beast. So, what's the difference? Well, the woman is going to be the great city of Rome. That's what it's going to tell us later on in the chapter. Because actually an angel is going to come and interpret all this for John. So, the woman is going to represent the city of Rome, whereas the beast itself is going to represent the imperial power of Rome that carries the city, that carries the woman, you understand? So, hence the heads of the Caesars and so forth. So the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls. So she's very wealthy. Rome is very wealthy, a wealthy city. Holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. This is an important allusion, this cup that she's holding in her hand, because it alludes to a prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 51. Flee from the midst of Babylon. Let everyone save his life. This is going to be an important theme. Be not cut off in her punishment, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance, the repayment he is rendering her. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand, making all the earth drunken. The nations drank of her wine. Therefore, the nations went mad. Suddenly, Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail for her. Take balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. Jeremiah 51, verses 6 through 8. Now, Jeremiah's prophecy is actually not about Rome. Do you know what Jeremiah is talking about? Babylon. And when Jeremiah talks about Babylon, it represents Babylon. Yeah. Because Jeremiah is not giving us apocalypse here. Instead, in Jeremiah's day, Babylon is the big threat. Babylon is the enemy. King Nebuchadnezzar is coming against Jerusalem. He comes against the kingdom of Judea. He destroys the city of Jerusalem. He's the one who burns the temple. And Babylon is the empire, the world empire, that takes the stage at that time and then carries the Jewish people into exile, hence the Babylonian exile and so forth. So Jeremiah's concern is literally with Babylon. So why are we seeing this prophecy being invoked here? Well, as we read on in our text, it says, she had in her hand this cup, a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality, and on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great. Okay, this should be confusing now. Because on the one hand, I told you the woman is Rome. Then I told you when Jeremiah is talking about Babylon, he's talking about Babylon. And now it says that the woman's name is Babylon. So which is it? There are some who would suggest that this prophecy is actually directed against Babylon, because Babylon actually was still a real place in the days of the apostles. It wasn't called Babylon anymore. It's called the Parthian Empire. But some would say, you know, we've shifted our attention over here to Parthia. And you had one of the largest Jewish communities in the world living out there in the Parthian Empire. And look behind me, I've got the Babylonian Talmud up here on the wall, you know. So Babylon was a center of Jewish population in those days. But actually, it's a little simpler than all of that. We're using Babylon as a cipher for Rome. So Rabbi Lichtenstein explains, when it says her name, the name that was written was Mystery Babylon. He says, first of all, when it says mystery in the Greek, that's a parenthetical statement to mean, you know, that this is encoded. This is we're into a code word here, just like we've seen codes being used earlier in the book of Revelation to obscure the names of the Caesars. So he says mystery. The meaning for this is that there is a mystery here that is prohibited from being revealed. For the meaning concerns the city of Rome, just as it is in the verse after this, which says she was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of Yeshua's witnesses. And it is the same further down in a few other verses. Yet out of fear of the empire, John wrote Babylon here, as well as in chapter 14, verse 8, chapter 16, verse 19, and so on. And if you want to see further, you could see his comments on 13, 19. Many of the sages of Israel also wrote Babylon in place of Rome, in the Talmud and in the Midrash, just as I stated in my commentary to 1 Peter 5. All right, well, what is 1 Peter 5? 1 Peter 5 is when Peter writes at the end of his epistle, he writes, she who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark my son. So it's just a salutation and at the end, a postscript at the end of his epistle, indicating that he is in Rome. But rather than giving away his location in written correspondence in a time of persecution, he uses a code. The code is Babylon. Why are we calling Rome Babylon? Where does the code come from? Let's talk about the real Babylon. Go back to Nebuchadnezzar. Babylon didn't start with Nebuchadnezzar. Babylon started with the Tower of Babel, right? Babel. Why is it called Babel? Because the languages were divided at that time and people began to babble, right? Well, actually, Babel, in the Semitic languages, it means gate of God. The gate of God. Building a tower called Babel, it's an idea. The idea is to reach to the heavens, to reach to the place where the gods dwell. That was the idea of Babylon, that is to be a city. It's a city, a divine city that can challenge heaven. So we'll raise up a tower and make a name for ourselves, the Tower of Babel, right? And it becomes a city-state. You know what a city-state is? It's where one city is the government ruling over a much larger territory, right? So Babylon was a city-state that became universal in the days of the Tower of Babel under a king called Nimrod. Nimrod considered himself to be divine. He considered himself to be a god. He was the first of these god-men, kings, and he demanded that he should be worshipped. This is the Jewish story of the Tower of Babel and the origin of Babylon. So, think about it. You have a single city over a one world order. Okay? And at the head of this single city is a divine king that you have to worship. What does that sound like? It sounds to me like the kingdom of heaven.
Oh. Yeah.
You have a single city, Zion, Jerusalem, over a one world order, the kingdom, the Messianic era, ruled by a divine king. So what we see is that the idea of Babylon is the opposite of the idea of the kingdom of heaven. To signify this, when Hashem strikes the Tower of Babel, he splits the languages so nobody can understand each other. When he initiates the kingdom, he unites the languages into one language. First, with the gift of the tongues at Shavuot, and people can understand, you know, everybody says, hey, he's speaking in my language. And then ultimately, it says in the prophets that he will, all mankind will serve him shoulder to shoulder with a pure lip, with a pure language. So, back to one language. So, the concept of Babylon from the apostolic perspective is the opposite, polar opposite of the kingdom of heaven. It's an important thing to see why we're referring to Rome then as Babylon. Rome, as the apostles see Rome, Rome is the anti-kingdom. Just like there's an antichrist, a Christ and antichrist, Messiah and false Messiah, Rome then stands as the anti-kingdom. It's the opposite of the kingdom of heaven. Moreover, Rome destroys Jerusalem and burns the temple, which is the same thing Babylon did. Rome carries the Jewish people into exile, which is the same thing Babylon did. So from the apostolic perspective, from John's perspective, it's very clear Babylon is the obvious name to apply to Rome. And if I say Babylon, you're going to know what I'm talking about. I don't have to say it because it's so explicit, it's so obvious. We'll go back to Lichtenstein's comment. So Lichtenstein is saying, the mystery is this. This is the mystery. You know, if you're looking too deep here, you're looking like, what is the mystery? This mysterious woman who rides a beast. You might be looking too deep. And anyway, we're going to get the explanation starting in verse 18, if we're up to it. All right. So Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes, it says in verse 5, and of the earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled greatly. What does it mean, I marveled greatly? It means I couldn't figure out what the vision was supposed to represent. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? Or why is this so cryptic to you? I will tell you the mystery of the woman. So now he's going to unravel it for us. And the mystery of the beast with the seven heads and the ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. This should sound familiar as well. The beast was, is not, and is about to corresponds to he who was, who is, and who will be. So once again, it's representing the opposite. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It says in the book of Hebrews, right? So once again, we're seeing this flipping of the coin, so to speak. So this beast, this is the same beast who is receiving worship from all the earth and saying, who is like the beast, and so forth. He was, he is not, he is about to rise from the bottomless pit. What does this mean? The dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel. They'll marvel to see the beast because, so this is going to be very confusing when they see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. You see this, how he's playing with this? It's remarkable, I think. Did you ever notice that before? Because I never noticed that before. I know I've been emphasizing that point as we've been going through this, you know, who was, who is, and who is to come as being one of the major themes of the book of Revelation. But I never noticed it here before. So this all calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. That helps clear it up. Exactly. If we lived in the ancient world, we would know that Rome is called the city on seven hills. That's a title for Rome. The city that sits on seven hills. And so when it says the seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits, the symbolism is not too difficult to unravel at this point. They are also seven kings. All right. Now, we've already established by saying that it's the city that sits on seven hills. We already know for sure that we're talking about Rome. There's no question that we're talking about the city of Rome. These seven heads also represent seven kings. Well, now all we need to do is count the kings of Rome, count the emperors. Very easy. Julius Caesar, 1. Augustus, 2. Tiberius, 3. Caligula, 4. Claudius, 5. Nero is 6. And then we have those three that we could count or not, but let's not. Vespasian, the destroyer of Jerusalem, would be number 7. And there's an 8th. How do you get an 8th? There's only 7 heads. Well, don't worry. Read on. It says, they are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. So, okay, 5 of whom have fallen. Julius Caesar, dead in that Shakespeare play. Augustus, dead. How did Augustus die? Possibly poisoned. Tiberius, possibly poisoned. Caligula, definitely poisoned. Claudius, definitely poisoned. Nero, people weren't sure. He committed suicide, so say the historians. It wasn't really clear. But if 5 of them are dead, Lichtenstein points out, this gives us a time stamp on this prophecy. That what we're seeing here in chapter 17 is not from Domitian's era. Instead, we're seeing a vision of the woman riding the beast from the end of Nero's reign, when the woman was really drunk with the blood of the saints. And before Vespasian, or Jerusalem is about to fall, and before Vespasian has taken his seat. So during the chaotic period of Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. That's what Lichtenstein says. So he says, and this book of John's vision, or this part of John's vision, was written at the end of the cruel Nero's life when he abdicated the throne and went to an unknown place, and the rebellious uprising began. That was Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. So when it says, 5 of them have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come, and when he does, he must remain only a little while. This has to refer then to Vespasian. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th. So there's your 8, Antichrist, number 8. But it belongs to the 7. That's why he was Nero. Now he is dead or not, or who knows. And he is going to come in the future as the second coming of Nero. This is the understanding. So for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction. Not a big surprise, we've already learned all this. But let's say that this is a prophecy from the end of Nero's reign, and then take it forward into Domitian's reign, and understand how the believers would look at this prophecy, and they would say, oh, this is what he meant. This is what we were shown. This is what we saw. This Domitian is the second coming of Nero. Verse 12. And the 10 horns that you saw, these are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. All right, these 10 kings, these refer back to the previous chapter. As the 7 bowls are being poured out, there it is, verse 12 of chapter 16. The 6th angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates. Its water was dried up to prepare the way for the kings from the east. These demonic spirits perform signs and go abroad to the kings of the whole world to assemble them for the battle on the great day of God. And we learn that's Gog and Magog. So the 10 kings, who are the 10 kings? These 10 kings are sent. These 10 kings are part of the coalition that comes against Jerusalem. So here's the missing piece of history that maybe would help you understand what's going on here. When Nero put together his coalition, he sent his legions to attack Judea, to attack Jerusalem. It's an incredible expenditure of imperial money to put an army out, right? And so he called on client states all around the area to contribute their armies. And Rome has, as the kingmakers, Rome has the ability to make someone a king or say, you're no longer a king. So if you want to be king, if you want to hold power, you need to work with the emperor. So Nero pulled together all these different, and Vespasian after him did the same thing, all these different client states contributed their armies to go up against Jerusalem in the siege of Jerusalem. So you have present at the siege of Jerusalem, not just the Romans, but all sorts of different armies. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing a sort of a replay of that. They're saying in the future, when Gog and Magog come, the Antichrist is going to make kings of people in order that they will cooperate in going up against Jerusalem. That's all that it's saying. Where does this come from, though? That's what confused me. And just by chance, I accidentally found it. Really? What does it mean that this woman was beside the many waters? It tells us. What are the many waters? I thought this was the strangest thing. Verse 15 says, "And the angel said to me, 'The waters that you saw, where the prostitute is seated, are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages.'" So I thought, well, that's very, I can think of a few psalms and that sort of thing where that imagery comes from. But really, where does this idea of the many waters come from? So here's the trick to Bible study. I did a word search on the Bible for the term many waters. That's all. And I found this prophecy from Jeremiah 51. Listen to this. "Sharpen the arrows, take up the shields. The Lord has stirred up the spirit of the king of the Medes." Who's the Medes? They're the Parthians now across the Euphrates. Remember the Euphrates drying up a moment ago? "Because his purpose concerning Babylon is to destroy it. For that is the vengeance of the Lord, the vengeance for his temple. Set up a standard against the walls of Babylon. Make the watch strong. Set up watchmen. Prepare the ambushes. For the Lord has both planned and done what he spoke concerning the inhabitants of Babylon. O you who dwell by many waters, rich in treasures, your end has come. The thread of your life is cut." All right, so in this prophecy from Jeremiah, he's talking about the end of the Babylonians. The end of the Babylonian Empire is going to be overthrown by the Medes and the Persians, right? But our text in Revelation has taken the essentials of this prophecy and reapplied them to the new Babylon, to Rome, and said, how is Rome going to fall? Rome is going to fall the same way by these kings of the East, the Parthians, who are going to come and destroy Rome. But first, they have to participate with the beast under the authority of Rome in the war of Gog and Magog. And then, when the beast is destroyed, when Rome is beaten, Gog and Magog is destroyed, they will turn on the city. So, it says, let's go back a little bit to verse 12, "And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power. They are to receive authority as kings." So Rome will appoint kings. You're a king, you're a king, you're a king, you're a king. "For 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind. And they hand over their power and authority to the beast." This is so that they should go up against Jerusalem. "They will make war on the Lamb." This is the final battle, which we've already seen played out several times. "And the Lamb will conquer them." This is the end of Gog and Magog when he stands on the Mount of Olives. "For he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, 'The waters you saw where the prostitute is seated, these are the peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute, and they will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled."
You mean they turn on each other?
Yeah. Yeah, it means that after the battle, the nations that have been assembled for war will turn their wrath back against the beast, against Rome. That's the idea. So here's the vision as it's being played out. The beast rises up in Rome. He sends out his legions to destroy Jerusalem and to make war against the Lamb and the people of God. The angels pouring out the bowls have already dried up the Euphrates to make way for the armies of the East to come and join him. He appoints kings from the armies of the East to join the Roman legions. In this way, all nations come up against Jerusalem to destroy the city. However, the Messiah comes and stands on the Mount of Olives, and he speaks, a sharp sword comes from his mouth, meaning he speaks a word, he says, death. And the armies of Gog and Magog fall dead on the plains of Armageddon or the Valley of Jehoshaphat or however you want to see it. Right. But there are survivors. And the survivors then, after the appointed time, after these things have been fulfilled, the survivors turn against the city of Rome that had employed them to fight against King Messiah. And they are the ones who sack and burn and destroy Rome in the next chapter. What we're seeing is sort of a midrashic, apocalyptic retelling of the prophecy of the fall of Babylon from Jeremiah, sending the Medes and the Persians, because this is exactly what it said regarding the Medes, you know, set up a standard and so forth. You who dwell by many waters, it says, for the Lord has both planned and done what he spoke concerning the inhabitants of Babylon. Just as he used the Medes to carry out this purpose, he's going to use these kings of the East. All right, that's the wrath of the ten kings. So Lichtenstein says, after the words of God come to pass in regards to his decree over Israel, that is, after 42 months, and the Lamb will conquer them, and those slain who fell in the land of Israel, just as the prophets prophesied, they will return with great anger and burn her up with fire. There we go. That's the end of the chapter, right? Yeah, it's the end of the chapter. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. Just like I told you. Okay. That's the end of the chapter. But it didn't really work out that way, did it? I mean, historically speaking, if we follow the story of history, the next king after Nero, the next emperor after Nero was Vespasian, so we're still on track there. But the next emperor after him was Titus, and after him, Domitian. And in any case, Rome didn't fall then. Rome stood for several hundred more years. And it wasn't the Parthians, despite what everybody expected, who actually took Rome down in the end, was it? It was the Vandals, it was the Goths, it was the barbarians, right? That overran Rome. So history played out in a different way than this apocalypse is suggesting. But that's the way apocalypse works. Apocalypse gives you a snapshot of the spiritual situation as it stands at the moment. And there is always, with apocalypse, with this kind of prophecy, you have to read it with the understanding that this is a potential outcome. Because even by the time of that John was writing and putting this together, this prophecy that we just read about seven heads, we already had an extra head in there. We already had Titus intervening. He could have edited it, I suppose, cleaned it up a little bit, but instead he communicated it the way he had received it from the Spirit. I hope I'm not confusing you too much, but this is Rabbi Lichtenstein's fault, really. I mean, all of this, this entire interpretation is really based on his reading of the book of Revelation, but I think it's really brilliant.
Have there been other large apocalyptic visions or something that have come to pass that have been exactly the same, exactly, or have they all?
No, I don't know of a single apocalypse that has ever worked out.
Okay.
the way that the prophecies present.
Okay.
But it's this idea, it's this Jewish idea that Messiah can come in every generation. That every generation has the potential of being the last generation. That Messiah could come any day, you know? There's not just one fixed ending that has to play out according. Instead, there's multiple potential scenarios that might occur to fulfill the prophecies. But we see the same major pieces of the eschatology always then being fulfilled. The characters change who fill the different roles, but the story stays the same. The battle of Gog and Magog, you know, according to the Talmud, at one time Hashem considered that he should make the Assyrians Gog and Magog, and King Hezekiah should be the Messiah. And so this was the plan up until he decided, I don't know about Hezekiah. And at the last minute, he put the brakes on that plan and decided to bring Messiah later. this is what it says in the Talmud, but it shows you the Jewish perspective on eschatology is much more loose than we're accustomed to.
Thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the support tab at bethemanuel.org.